Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. Welcome to Conversation for Exploration. Hi, I'm your host, Loralee. In these days, now more than ever, we need to learn the lessons of compassion. Who do you go for that? Well, I can think of none better than the Dalai Lama himself and his new book, An Open Heart, Practicing Compassion in Everyday Life, which was edited by our guest today, Nicholas Freeland, who's the director of the Tibet Center, is here to join us and tell us about that message of compassion, how we can incorporate more of that in our everyday life. Nicholas joins us from New York City. Hi, how are you?
Well, thank you. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Where are you from originally, Nicholas?
Well, I'm a New Yorker I suppose I've adopted New York. I was born in Switzerland and lived in different countries in Europe through my childhood, as well as in North Africa, and came to live here at 13, and then went abroad again to France. So
you've been around.
People say, where are you from? That's a hard one to answer. I let you decide.
How many are you a practicing Buddhist?
I'm a Buddhist monk, actually.
What does that mean? There's so many different sects, and how do you become a monk? And is there at one point where you're kind of an initiate, and then you become a full-fledged monk? How does that work?
Well, you have to want to become a monk. I was in the subway here, and a homeless man came up to me and said, "Are you a monk?" And I said, "Yes," because I'm wearing robes. And he said, "How does one become a monk?" And I said, "Well, the first thing you have to do is want to." And he said, "Well, then I suppose I don't want to be a monk." In other words, you have to have the desire to commit your life to a spiritual path, and there are vows involved. There are four root vows. There's a vow of celibacy. There's a vow not to steal or to kill human beings or to tell a great lie. And then there are many other vows, over 200 other vows, which support those four vows. And the interesting thing in the Buddhist monastic tradition is that if you break one of those vows, one of those four root vows, you're no longer a monk. Whether you walk around in robes, whether you or others acknowledge the fact that you're not a monk, you have broken your vows and are therefore no longer a monk. So being a monk is making this rather serious commitment to a spiritual path, in this case Buddhism, thereby sort of clearing aside things that might hinder your devotion to your path. So that's what being a monk is, and I became a monk 16 years ago. Actually, I was made a monk, ordained by His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Bodh Gaya, in the place where the Buddha is said to have attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree.
That's very special. That's just no run-of-the-mill monk, isn't it?
Well, many monks choose to or hope to receive their ordination there. We consider that it's a blessed place. So, yes, there are actually many monks who've been ordained there, though it is very fortunate. Yes.
And I don't think there's any run-of-the-mill monks anyway, because really it's a pact between you and God. What is the Buddhist definition of or understanding of God?
Well, we don't actually talk about God. We put the emphasis of our spiritual devotion on our own shoulders. In other words, we devote ourselves to doing good or developing virtuous tendencies and diminishing non-virtuous tendencies. So we really, as I say, place the responsibility squarely upon our own shoulders. We don't talk about a creator being. We consider that the world, the situation in which we live, is the manifestation of what we merit, what we deserve given our past actions. And the future situation that we will find ourselves in will be based upon our present actions. So we don't talk about God. We really talk about virtuous actions.
So there seems to be in every religion a motivation to be a good person beyond just the fact that you should be. Either go to heaven or you get a better situation in the next life. Is that, that's part of it, built in?
Well, and also you make the people around you happy. Mm-hmm. You know, when you act, let's say you get angry, not only would we say that in the future you will live or reap the consequences of such actions, but those around you are affected. In the same way, positive actions do lead to your own happiness in the future, but they also lead to the happiness of those whom you make happy.
You were the director of the Tibet Center. What does the center do? How did you become its director?
Well, the Tibet Center is a Tibetan Buddhist religious center that was established about 26 years ago by a Tibetan Lama called Chungla Rato Rinpoche. And it's the first Tibetan Buddhist center here in New York, and he is one of the first lamas to have come to the United States and established himself here. I came to study with him about 25 years ago, and after a few years, developed the desire to become a monk. And then after a few more years of his sort of keeping me away from that, so testing me, I would say, he sent me to his monastery, which was reestablished in a Tibetan refugee settlement in the south of India, where I went, became a monk, and spent 14 years studying in the traditional Tibetan system of studying philosophy and logic. After that, he asked me to return to help him here at the center by teaching and by running the center. So I became the center's director, really, because my teacher asked me to.
Of all the vows, those four basic vows that you've kept over the last 16 years, which have been the most challenging to keep for you personally?
In terms of the specific vow, I would say that the vow of celibacy would be the most difficult, just because I'm a regular person who is attracted to women, and that's the one that's the most challenging. Though I think that what is challenging is maintaining one's priorities as a spiritual practitioner, and I don't think that that involves any particular vow. I think that that really involves life in general, and the whole idea of being a monk. When you're living in a monastery with a bunch of monks, it's not very difficult. The community, the situation enables you to remain conscious of the commitment that you've made, the priorities that those commitments entail. When you're living in a city like New York, where I've been for over 2 years, it's a little trickier. I wear my robes, and I do so in order to establish the fact that I'm a monk, not only for those who see me walking around, but also for myself. In other words, the robes themselves remind me of the commitment that I've made, keep me aware of what I wish to be kept aware of, which is that I'm a monk, And that's not, it's not that you do that simply to state to the world and to yourself that you're a Buddhist monk, but it's to help you think like one. It's to help you think not in worldly terms, but in, let's say, more spiritual terms. When taking the subway, when the subway is late, instead of saying to myself, oh, damn it, the subway is late, I have an appointment, I'm starting to get angry, I have to sort of control myself. And being a monk and standing there in these robes helps me maintain the awareness, the mindfulness that gets me to start thinking in other ways, thinking how extraordinary this network of tunnels underneath Manhattan and the rest of New York is, how many people worked so hard in order to provide me with the ability to zap underground from place to place. So it's like that.
Why do you have a shaved head? Is that standard among monks?
I do. It is.
What's the purpose for that? And I've seen also women Buddhist monks with a shaved head. Why would the women want to shave their head as well?
Well, it's not that one necessarily wants to, but let's talk more in respect to what it would have been like to shave one's head 20, 30 years ago when it wasn't a style, because it's funny that today there are many people who shave their heads.
You're fashionable now.
Exactly. So going before it became fashionable, our hair was a very important part of our personality and how we presented ourselves to the world. And to simply shave that off, to remove that, was removing our personality, was removing that sort of outward sign of whom we felt we were. And a monk does that. A monk or a nun is removing those aspects of their expression of their sense of self. Now, I've been using the past tense because, as I say, today people have adopted this as their personality, as their sense of self, and that's that makes it all sort of strange.
I've also heard that that's the reason why when you go into boot camp in the Army, they shave your hair.
So, I didn't know that.
I don't know. That's just one explanation I've heard.
Now, so we wear a uniform like the soldiers do, and we shave our heads the way they do. Yeah, it's removing one's own personality in these two ways, yeah.
The Buddha was married with children. Why the celibacy?
Oh, well, the Buddha was initially married with children. However, when he became a monk, when he left his household and went to the forest, he took his sword and he shaved his head, and from then on was a monk. He remained celibate. So it's not that one has to have always been celibate. It's that from when one makes the commitment, one remains celibate. Why does one do it? Well, one maybe...
It's a big sacrifice on you guys' part, so it must be a really good reason. I was just curious what it was.
You know, there are those who say it's a cop-out, that it's not a sacrifice at all, that in a sense we're avoiding the responsibilities and the challenges that married life, that having children entail. And I think that there's a certain truth to that. I think that there are certain challenges. I think that there are certain opportunities for developing selflessness, for developing concern for others, for developing compassion and loving kindness that present themselves in family life that simply do not when one is a monk. However, that family situation also demands a lot of time, demands a lot of concerns, preoccupations.
That you'd have to reprioritize your life, too.
That's right. And so we simply remove those things that would distract us from our devotion to a more rigorous spiritual practice.
So it's not the attitude that sex is bad, it's more that sex comes with responsibilities to be a family man, and you're choosing not to have that path.
That's right. And there's another aspect to it, which is that the pull towards sex is, it's a desire. And to use an example which is not sex, we have desires for things. We have desires for, I was a photographer for many years, and I can speak with great mastery of my desire for cameras. And that the interesting thing about desire is that it leads to more desire. In the camera situation, when I recognized the need for a particular camera, I was sure that that particular camera would solve all my problems, that that was really the key to everything. And however, once I had acquired it, it didn't take long before I felt the need for maybe another one, in order to have one for black and white, one for color, maybe a dissatisfaction with the particular film size that it limited me to. Maybe I wanted a bigger camera, etc. And desire is that way. And I think that it works exactly the same way with sex. Our desire for our involvement with someone, our attraction to someone, all that has this quality of wishing for something that we do not have, wishing to satisfy our own desire. And the thing about that is that it seems to have in it the seeds for discontentment with the situation. In other words, when we behave wishing to simply satisfy ourselves, we become dissatisfied, that there are the seeds for dissatisfaction.
So you're just opting not even to get on that treadmill.
Sorry?
So you're opting not even to get
exactly
on that treadmill.
And, you know, I want to apologize to all the people who are living there for what may sound like a very anti-relationship stand. I'm as... goodness, I think that there is so much to learn from relationships. I think that there are so many opportunities for inner growth through relationships. I'm simply talking about one aspect of it, which is this desire business. And I think it's easier to locate it and to understand it when we're talking in respect to an object. However, in Tibetan texts, desire is discussed as being like salt water. The more you drink, the more you want to drink, the more it seems to generate more thirst.
Are you happier as a Buddhist monk these last 16 years than prior in your life?
I think so. I'm
more content.
Well, you know, the only way you can really answer that is if you look around and see how your old friends, your peers are doing. And it's interesting in respect to that particular aspect of the monastic commitment. Most of my friends are on their third marriage, if it's the second or the third marriage, so that it's not as if they found the sort of inner peace and happiness in a commitment and in a marriage and in a family that they all thought they would when they started out. In terms of the other aspects, most of them are doing rather well, I would say, in their business or if they're artists in that sense. But I think I'm happier. I think looking around that there's a sort of inner peace and contentment that I've been working on and have actually developed a little bit of that makes me maybe a little bit happier. However, I think it best one would have to ask them.
I would say also that this is not the path for adrenaline junkies, or maybe it's the cure for adrenaline junkies or those who like the highs and the lows. It sounds like it's for
it
a
really
nice
isn't.
Medium. Yeah, the middle road, right? The right
yep.
road.
Yep.
Yep. One question about the Buddhism and the current diaspora of Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhism, and then I want to ask you about meeting the Dalai Lama and what is he like in person. But first, I have to ask you, I was lamenting to a friend about, you know, the world need now more than ever those people who are holding the space. And I'm really sad that after all the thousands of Buddhist monks that were there in their monasteries who were doing their prayers, I really think that that helped to keep the world on an even keel, and we need them now more than ever. And he said, yeah, but, you know, it's sad about the destruction of the monasteries and how many monks were killed and all this. But he said one good thing of it has come is that now Tibetan Buddhism has been exported around the world along with the message of compassion. I would like your insights into that.
Well, I can't say that I'm thankful to the Chinese communists for having invaded China, Tibet, and forced His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Tibetans to come out and thereby brought us Buddhism. There's some element of appreciation for the fact that I have had access to this extraordinary path. Yes, that is, let's say, a positive aspect. I do recognize that the intensity of practice, the extraordinary spiritual practitioners who were in hermitages up in the mountains of Tibet, or the pursuit of inner realization intellectual mastery of Buddhist philosophy that was taking place in the great monastic universities, though still there in exile in India, is not there to the extent that it was in Tibet, and that's an enormous tragedy, as is the terrible suffering that so many of these people underwent in 1959 and thereafter. I don't know that I consider it to have been a good fortune. I don't know that if you sort of...
I think he said it was at least a silver lining to a very dark cloud.
Very dark. I think we have to remember that it has been pretty dark.
Yeah. And then you wonder, after all, generating all this compassion and love and peace, how does something like that happen to that, you know, focus? Doesn't seem fair.
You know, the laws of karma are very hard to understand. They are considered to be a very hidden truth.
Very hidden.
Yes, something that we simply cannot see directly. And we do believe that the suffering that we experience is due to our own non-virtuous actions in the past, but long in the past. It's not as if you say to some person who has been a good person all his life or her life, who suddenly is afflicted with some illness or some tragedy or difficulty, this is because of something that you have recently done. No, we all have within us an enormous amount of non-virtue that is ready to express itself. We've been around for countless lifetimes, and we've all been good people, bad people, mediocre people, and still have to experience the fruit of those actions. And a Tibetan Buddhist practitioner would recognize that and would realize that whatever difficulty he or she was experiencing would have been due to his or her own past actions, and that the more patiently one endures that, and I'm not saying just letting oneself be pushed around, but accepting things in a spiritual way helps one diffuse the power of that past negative action and thereby get rid of its effects.
So that explains why, and it's just marvelous to me how the Dalai Lama, through all that Tibetan Buddhism has been through and his fellow monks, how he continues to smile and preach compassion and forgiveness.
It's true. His ability to accept what's happened and to not get angry is really an inspiration for all of us.
And therein is the major lesson here. Tell us about how this book, An Open Heart, Practicing Compassion in Everyday Life, came to be. I understand the Dalai Lama was there in New York, a couple years ago, giving a series of lectures, and it's from those lectures that the book was written?
Yes. Richard Gere and his Gere Foundation and the Tibet Center invited His Holiness to New York. Actually, initially in 1991, we invited him to bestow something called a Kalachakra initiation, which is some sort of higher tantric initiation, which he did in the great our great stadium, our great Madison Square Garden, and we invited him back to commemorate that in 1999, and we asked him to give certain teachings on Buddhism at the Beacon Theater, which actually is usually used by rock concerts, rock musicians for concerts, by the Kabuki Theater, and we set the theater up as a Buddhist temple, and had a big traditional Tibetan throne. And the Dalai Lama taught for 3 days, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon, in a very traditional way.
Tell me what that traditional way is when we come back. We're talking with Nicholas Vreeland, director of the Tibet Center in New York. He's the editor of the Dalai Lama's book, An Open Heart, Practicing Compassion in Everyday Life. He'll continue the story of how this book and these teachings came to be, and tell us what those teachings are and how we can apply them to our own lives. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.
Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. Our guest is Nicholas Vreeland, director of the Tibet Center and editor of the book An Open Heart, Practicing Compassion in Everyday Life by the Dalai Lama. You've been telling us a bit about the series of lectures that Richard Gere set up. So, so handy to have a celebrity in your camp, isn't it, to make some of these things happen. And tell us more about how this came to be, series of lectures.
We invited the Dalai Lama to New York in 1999. We asked him to give teachings on a text called Stages of Meditation by the 8th century Indian master Kamalashila, who had actually been invited to Tibet at that time in order to establish how to practice Buddhism correctly. And the king of Tibet then asked him to write a text about it, and so he wrote this Stages of Meditation in Tibet. So the Dalai Lama taught that. He also taught something called the 37 Practices of Bodhisattvas by a 14th century Tibetan practitioner, and he interwove these two. One is a poem with these very inspiring verses on how to behave correctly, how to diminish our non-virtuous tendencies and develop virtuous ones. The other is sort of a manual on different aspects of meditation and philosophy. These were rather serious, intense teachings for 3 days to people who had signed up to come for 3 days, so that they were serious Buddhists. We then asked him to teach in Central Park to people, to everyone, an open session. And we didn't really know how many people would show up, and we thought that maybe we would get 20 or 30,000. We hoped that many people would be interested in coming to hear the Dalai Lama. However, over 200,000 people came. It was extraordinary.
Did you have to turn away some people, or were you able to fit them all in?
Well, we had a big jumbo screen, and we couldn't turn people away. They just sat farther away and couldn't see him. They could just see maybe the top of the screen, and we had speakers all over the place so that people could hear well. No one was turned away. And there he talked he spoke only in English, while at the Beacon Theater everything was translated through his translator.
He spoke only in Tibetan, you mean?
He spoke in Tibetan, and mm-hmm. the translator then conveyed things in English. In Central Park, he spoke directly. And so then I was asked to take all these teachings, the three serious days and then this public talk, and make a book out of this. And that's what this Open Heart is. And it's an interesting book in the history of the Dalai Lama's teaching, public teachings, because it's the first book which is really marketed to a general audience, which is spoken in Buddhist terms. His most successful book, The Art of Happiness, which he did with an American psychiatrist, Howard Cutler, has been extremely popular, but it's the Dalai Lama's philosophy conveyed through discussions with Howard Cutler. And so it's Howard Cutler's explanation of the Buddhist views. The second most popular book is something called Ethics for the New Millennium, where the Dalai Lama conveys his ideas in non-Buddhist terms, trying to show the logic of his ideas without getting into religion or spirituality. While here, we decided that we would convey the Dalai Lama's message in traditional Buddhist terms, introducing the Buddhist path to a general audience. And what's wonderful is that people are interested, is that the book is selling, that people at this particular time, and understandably, these are maybe not usual times, people are interested in the Dalai Lama's spiritual path and teaching.
So it really gets into the topography of Tibetan Buddhism, the intellectual constructs and the seven stages of meditation and the various practices. And before we get into the details of that, I have a couple of other questions for you. You mentioned what a lot of study of historical texts, of intellectual know-how that's been put down from prior lamas and sages in the Buddhist practice are there. So what does a typical day consist of for you and for other monks? It sounds like a lot of study, not just doing the prayers and the rituals. What are those about, and how much study is there?
Well, the monastery that I belong to, which is called Rato Monastery, is a typical, maybe smaller monastic university, and it was established outside of Lhasa, the capital of Tibet, in the 14th century. And was reestablished in India in 1983. In Tibet, it had about 500 monks, and they were devoted to the study of Buddhist logic, particularly. That's what the monastery was established for, and Buddhist philosophy, the application of that logic to philosophy in order to establish what is right or wrong logically. What we do is pretty much what was done in Tibet. The monks start their day by memorizing the root text they're studying. It's said that early in the morning your mind is able to absorb things more easily. And so you start, and you have, today there are about 80 monks at Rato. The monks are all repeating a line of the text over and over, different lines. Everyone is studying something different, and everyone is able to memorize at a different pace. So you have this loud shouting of all the monks as they're trying to memorize their texts in their rooms in the morning. And then that's for let's say an hour or two, and then tea is served. And usually, if there aren't prayers in the prayer hall, someone will go around with a big kettle of tea and pour a little tea into each monk's mug, and a piece of bread is given to each monk, and they'll continue with their studies and their memorization. If we have prayers, then we all go to the prayer hall, a little temple within the building, and we would be served our tea and given our bread there, and we would say the prayers that that particular service was devoted to. Then at 9 o'clock, there's a gong that goes off, and we all go to the debating court, which is in the large monastery that we're associated with.
Well, that sounds like fun.
And we debate for a few hours. We debate with people who are studying the same thing that we are. And you'll have in the debating court 500-600 monks pairing up in twos. And one will sit and the other one will stand. And the seated one will defend and the standing one challenges. And a topic of discussion is presented by the challenger. And then the two pursue the subject together, discussing it, but not discussing it, just having a chat about it, but the challenger challenges the position of the defendant using logical constructs, trying to take something from the defendant's answer and throwing it back at him in the form of a consequence to trip him up and to explore the ramifications of a particular interpretation. These are very vivacious, and you'll have the monks are really shouting over each other, because when you have 500 monks together,
It can get loud.
And it is extraordinary. It is the heart of the monastery. It is the heart of Tibetan Buddhism being preserved.
It's fascinating. It's competition, it's a game, and it really makes you take in the knowledge and learn it very thoroughly, doesn't it?
It does, and it forces you to establish the validity of something by yourself. You do not accept something because you're told that it's this way. You scrutinize it by applying logic, and it is believed that you can go much farther if you do this in pairs, because you push each other to really explore the ramifications in this way.
Well. Do a lot of monasteries do this, or is this rather unique to yours?
It's a tradition that was maintained within the three great monastic universities around Lhasa in Tibet, as well as a few monastic universities in different parts of eastern Tibet. These were monasteries that people came to from all around Tibet in order to study, so that it was sort of like going to university.
Sure.
You didn't find such study in the little monasteries that you found in virtually every village in Tibet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. These were the big centers of learning where this was taking place.
Which were enormous. The big monastery that we would go to in order to debate every day, for example, which today in exile has 3,000 monks.
Wow. This is in India?
In India, in the south. In Tibet had over 10,000 monks. So that they were important centers for study. But in India, in the middle of what had been jungle until the land was given to the Tibetans, this whole syllabus, this whole curriculum has been reestablished and is being preserved.
Wow. Thank you. So after the debate hour, what then would be the rest of your day? Typically?
Well, the debate goes on for a few hours. In the middle, there'll be a time when the disciplinarian calls us all into the main temple and there's a prayer that is said in order that we reestablish our motivation. We are not pursuing knowledge in order to simply know more or in order to defeat our opponent in debate. We are doing so in order to diminish our selfishness, our self-cherishing, and in order to develop compassion and loving-kindness in order to better help all beings.
So go back to center. Remember your purpose there.
Yeah. Go back to center, yes. And then we have lunch.
What is a typical lunch? Because I met some Kyoto monks who were doing the throat singing, and I was able to go backstage and be introduced, and they were eating yak meat and yak butter, and it was fascinating. It had a wonderful aroma.
Yes. You know, people are always shocked at the fact that Buddhist monks in the Tibetan tradition, and actually in most Buddhist traditions, eat meat. However, a monk is meant to eat what he's served. Traditionally, monks have begging bowls, and what is put into the begging bowl, they are meant to eat. You are not allowed to eat something if it is killed for you. In other words, if you go to someone's house and they're going to kill something in order to feed you, that you have to refuse. But if they've already made chicken and they are offering you part of what they are eating, which was the traditional way in which monks fed themselves.
Because the chicken would be killed anyway, whether they were there or not, right?
And it would be wrong to refuse it.
I see.
So, yes, Tibetans who really didn't have much to eat other than meat in Tibet would eat, and a yak is considered a better animal to eat because killing one yak will feed many people. If you kill little things like fish or chicken, you have to kill a lot in order to feed the same amount of people.
Good logic. And also, I just can't imagine in that high mountain country that a lot of vegetables and grains would be growing, so you have to eat what's there. So what's a typical lunch in the monastery?
Well, in the south of India, it's a piece of bread and vegetables and a little bit of tea without milk. It'll just be tea and water, you know, black tea.
Mm-hmm.
When I first went, it was just bread and tea.
How can you live on just bread, though? Where's the protein? Where's the, the vitamins?
Oh, you're right. No, but we don't have much money. These monasteries are very, very poor. To find the money to feed monks is difficult. People have what they consider to be so much better things to give their money to, and it's very hard to find the money to feed monks.
Is there an active solicitation donation for monasteries? Is there one place where to give, where it's distributed, or how does that work?
Well, we established a little foundation here in America, the Rato Dratsang Foundation, to try to find money for, or to provide people in this country with a tax-exempt way of providing money for the monks. I'm not a very good fundraiser, and therefore haven't really been able to do much with this, but it's just a difficult situation. Anyone who would like to provide, we would be happy to receive donations because the monks really need them. And I will say this, these are people who are really devoting themselves to bettering themselves for the sake of all. They really are sacrificing normal lives in order to whittle away at their sense of self, their self-cherishing, in order to better serve all beings. They're really living up to that, and so a donation is really a worthy one.
And your website is thetibetcenter.org, and I'm sure you have some info there.
Yes, we do, and we have an address. Yes.
Tell me more about the typical day then. After lunch, vegetables, some bread, then what?
Then we take a nap. It's very hot in the south of India, and one is by that time really in need of even 15 minutes of rest in order to get through the rest of the day. So the whole monastery tends to sort of close down for half
siesta.
An hour or something. Yep. It sounds rather decadent, but it's really essential. And through the afternoon, because by this time we're at about, we have lunch between 11 and 11:30, so by about noon or 1, the different masters in the monastery, the elder monks, are teaching. And so one goes to study what one is in the process of studying. In other words, whatever the text is that one is presently studying, one goes to one's teacher to receive teachings on. And one, that lasts maybe an hour or so, and the text is explained by the master, and one will be maybe among 10, 20 other students, and we all sit on the ground, on the floor of the master's room, and he sits on his bed, and he teaches the text point by point, and he may ask questions of students in order to see that they've understood. And then one comes back to one's room and studies other texts and commentaries. One tries to understand what has just been taught to one, and that goes on until dinner, which is 5 o'clock, and which is not much more than what one had had for lunch. Usually, it's rice and dal, dal being
those lentily things that cook up into a soup.
Lentily things, yeah, that's. Usually we have rice and dal. Sometimes there'll be a noodle soup or vegetables and a little bit of meat if someone has given the monastery meat. And then in the evening, after dinner, we will recite what we've been memorizing. If you simply memorize in the morning, you'll forget what you've memorized a few days or a few weeks or a few months before. So you have to keep on reciting what you've memorized to keep it vital, to keep it memorized. And we do that for about an hour or so, sometimes longer. And then prayers begin that precede the evening debate. And they can vary in length, but they go on for about an hour or so, after which evening debate begins, usually at about between 8:30 and 9. And that goes on for a few hours. There are some monks who remain in the debating court until 1 o'clock in the morning. Some, like me, are collapsing by 10:30, 11, and return to their rooms and say their evening prayers and go to sleep.
Fascinating. What time do you usually get up in the monastery?
About between 5 and 5:30.
Mm-hmm. Does everybody have to participate in all, or can you just say, gosh, I really need just a day to myself? Let me check out.
Oh, no, no.
You can't do that.
Participate in all. We have a day off. Mondays are, you have to wash your clothes. You have to, you know, that's our day off. And that's a recent thing. There were no days off in Tibet. It's something that's been adopted in exile.
What did the monks do besides pray and study and debate? Do they have a community outreach? Are they there available to, traditionally in Tibet, were they there available to the villagers for counseling? Or was their job to hold prayer and raise the vibration of the world? What was the...
It was more the latter. It was really, there are, monks tend to remove themselves a little bit from society. It's better if you want to remain a monk and devote yourself to your internal spiritual development. It is better to remove yourself. The people in a village, people in lay communities, would seek the guidance, the spiritual advice of a lama, of a teacher, but the regular monastic community would remain sort of a little distant from lay life. Though people in villages will come and request that monks say prayers for them. They may make a small donation to the monastery. They may make, it's traditional, for example, for someone to offer a little bit of money to each monk. It won't be much. It'll be what would translate to maybe 25 cents or 50 cents or even less. And a person would request that a certain prayer be said for a certain purpose, and that person's request would be read before the assembly of monks. And then as the monks are saying those prayers, the patron would go around and offer to each monk a quarter or whatever it was.
That can be expensive for 500 monks.
It could be. It is. And However, this would be considered an act of generosity which the person would benefit from tremendously.
Mm-hmm. Now, how are monks chosen? I've seen very young boys in photographs or films or videos or whatever of the traditional monasteries. Or do people go out and live the householder life and then at some point decide, well, now it's time to turn to the spiritual pursuits?
Well, you have both. You have, though it's not probably a very good practice, you do have parents who put their children into monasteries with the belief that it'll somehow benefit the child. My experience is that those don't usually remain monks for very long. They tend to give up their robes when they...
reach 16?
When they reach 16. However, you have exceptions. You have extraordinary monks who have made it past 16 and really begun to have what I would call a vocation, a real commitment to this path. In the large monastic universities, in the most of the monasteries, in Tibetan monasteries that I am familiar with, it was rare that people... it is today rare that people become monks later in life. People will devote themselves to their spiritual practice later in life, but they won't necessarily become monks. There are some, but it's not the norm. People tend to become monks younger, in their late teens, early 20s.
They hear the call?
They hear the call, and you know, it's sometimes more difficult for us to understand that in our society because it's so foreign. But when you're living in a society that is so devoted to that kind of faith and that kind of commitment, it's not so strange. It's part of the culture.
I saw the movie 7 Years in Tibet. Was that about the Dalai Lama? Was that about him being found as a young boy and his training?
Yes. Yes. Oh. Did you also see Kundun, the film?
Yes, I saw that too.
That is a very, very fine depiction of the Dalai Lama's having been discovered and brought to Lhasa to assume his responsibilities, to begin his studies, and then his leaving Tibet in 1959. It's the Dalai Lama participated in the
storyline?
Yes, very much in that one.
You know, I have to say that that practice of looking for the child and then doing the test must work, because look at what an extraordinary person the Dalai Lama is. Who could have risen to the challenges of that job so well if you weren't really meant for it? And
so
born to it.
Absolutely.
Yep.
We're all so fortunate.
What is the Dalai Lama like when you meet him? How many people have access to him? What's his life like?
Well, his life is extraordinary because he does so much and he sees so many people, and he is involved in the running of his country in exile, in the negotiations for the freedom of his people, the liberties of his people in Tibet.
He's an activist as well now, huh?
Sorry?
He's an activist as well now.
He's an activist as well. And yet he has so much time for his own practice. He teaches. I am going to India in December to attend teachings that he'll be giving down in the monastery for a week or 10 days, where he'll teach for many hours a day. And he will have prepared for that, because to sit before, it'll be 5,000-6,000 monks and teach, and these are monks who are very, very familiar with the subject. The mastery that is needed in order to do that is extraordinary, and he has that. He truly has that. His particular interpretation of a text, his knowledge of the text, his ability to weave different commentaries into his explanation of that text is absolutely without
compare.
There's no one else who has it. It's extraordinary.
Well, what is he like as a person? What is it like to be in his presence?
Well,
have a chat with him.
I would say that, one doesn't hang out with him. One has an audience, and his ability to be absolutely focused on the person who is with him, no matter what the person has come there for, whether it's someone who considers themselves important enough to merit an audience, whether it's someone who's there for political reasons, whether it's someone who's there for spiritual guidance, whoever it is, whatever the reason, whether it's Tibetan refugees who've crossed the border into India, he meets every single Tibetan refugee who comes from Tibet. His concentration, his care, his concern for that individual, the person before him, is total. You really feel that he cares about you, that he cares about you as a human being, cares to help you along your path. And it's his warmth, it's his humor, it's his down-to-earthness that I find the most moving, the most powerful.
Thank you for that description, and thank you, Nicholas, for this hour. I look forward to the second hour with you, that we get to the heart of the message of compassion from the Dalai Lama, as we continue our conversation with the second hour with Nicholas Vreeland. Again, he's the director of the Tibet Center and the editor of the Dalai Lama's book, An Open Heart, Practicing Compassion in Everyday Life. I look forward to that. Thank you also, Nicholas, for I seized the opportunity that you were so open and so direct in answering questions I've had for a long, long time about what is life like as a monk in a monastery, what goes on. So I appreciate the picture, the very detailed picture that you painted of a monk's life. Appreciate that. And Nicholas will be back. Look for his second hour and practice your life with all the compassion you can muster. And visit the Tibet Center's website as well, thetibetcenter.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online. www.lauralee.com